chances to develop into their selves. There's a certain style of parenting these days that's getting in the way.
Not a long time has passed since the use of the word parenting. Until a few decades ago, this word did not exist at all. But it was after that it was widely used. Now, after 5 decades, this word has gained a lot of value. Some estimates say that this industry is worth $900 million. Children enter this industry from the first days of their lives. According to their parents, they should be prepared for the future. To succeed, improve social status, and be like Einstein and other geniuses. Now, what is seen in raising children is a competition, a fierce and popular competition, a competition that has raised many questions. Questions about the origin of parents' strange behavior.
We spend a lot of time being very concerned about parents who aren't involved enough in the lives of their kids, in their education or their upbringing, and rightly so. But at the other end of the spectrum, there's a lot of harm going on there as well, where parents feel a kid can't be successful unless the parent is protecting and preventing at every turn, and hovering over every happening, and micromanaging every moment, and steering their kid towards some small subset of colleges and careers. And then with our kids, our precious kids, we spend so much time nudging, cajoling, hinting, helping, haggling, nagging, as the case may be, to be sure they're not screwing up, not closing doors, not ruining their future, some hoped-for admission to a tiny handful of colleges that deny almost every applicant.
The early 20th century was an ambiguous time. On the one hand, there were talks about the World War I, and on the other hand, major transformation in science and technology. These changes could be kind of scary, like what happened in the same years for the film of the Lumiere brothers. These two brothers recorded a video of a few seconds of a train entering the station with their camera, a movie that scared the audience in its first screening. People at that time had no understanding of the concept of the cinema. Therefore, when they saw the train in the picture coming towards them, they all ran away from the hall. The story of this funny fear soon became a normal process, but the concept of fear was not something that would be resolved anytime soon. The newly established science of psychology was studying this concept in the same years. The prevailing opinion of that time said that fear is useful, especially for children. The root of this belief was in Aristotle's sentence. The sentence that said that the purpose of our education is to be able to fear correctly. Of course, the first psychologists were against this approach. They said that fear is harmful, especially for children. According to these people, being afraid in childhood has a bad effect on a person's personality. They mentioned all kinds of fears: fear of the dark, heights, animals, getting lost, and violence. Unpleasant fears that, according to psychologists, were the main cause of adult problems. In this situation, they pointed the accusing finger at the parents, an accusation that soon changed everything.
I am Dracula.
Dracula. The very mention of the name brings to mind things so evil, so fantastic, so degrading. You wonder if it isn't all a dream, a nightmare.
Rats. Thousands. Millions of them.
But no, this is no dream. This is Dracula. Dracula. original terrifying story of a maniac and a man who lived after death, lived on human blood, took the form of a vampire bat, and lured innocent girls to a fate truly worse than death.
Dracula.
In the first half of the 20th century, fear was an important issue for everyone. On the one hand, horror movies were profitable at the box office, and on the other hand, fear was suppressed in the heart of the society. The new approach to this concept said that fear is a disease, a deadly disease, which is caused by inappropriate behavior in childhood. Now, the situation had changed. Everyone expected parents to stop children's fear. Their new role was to protect the child from scary phenomena. It was forbidden to impose pressure on the child. Discipline was prohibited. Domineering behavior was prohibited. Parents should constantly approve and encourage the children. This approach was also extended to educational environments. The school's methods of punishment and treatment of students were constantly criticized. Criticism that cast a heavy and mysterious shadow on the concept of education within a few decades.
He's an intelligent child and a very attractive one. But Philip is a problem. At school, at home, to himself. Philip is an overly aggressive child. What can be done? We can say, oh, this is just a phase, he'll outgrow it. Or we can recognize that he needs help and that something can be done to help him.
It was in the early 70s that the term parenting became popular. The popularization of this concept was due to fear being recognized as a disease that should have been prevented in childhood. Now, parents were worried about scaring their children and were looking for new ways of education, new ways that rejected all previous trends. Taking care of children has always been an important task for parents. Since the time of the first humans, children have had a strong need for continuous care. This care required both higher precision and more time compared to the offspring of animals. On the other hand, before the modernization of societies, large families lived together. The multitude and accumulation of people made taking care of children a duty for everyone. Not a task for parents. Brothers, sisters, and first-degree relatives all played a role in taking care of the new children in the family. This process made every member of a family learn how to take care of a child. In addition, as the child grew older, he or she became involved in taking care of younger children. When the word parenting became popular, this trend had changed. Now, the families were smaller than before. Urbanization had also caused large families to be divided into smaller units, and each one settled in a corner of the city. Therefore, new parents knew less about children than previous generations. This situation worsened in the 80s and 90s. Now, parents who did not have brothers and sisters themselves did not know how to treat their only child. A dire situation had arisen. A situation that the popularization of another concept made it even worse. The pathology of fear progressed so much that a new term was born. A term called vulnerable child. For a few decades, children's resilience has been questioned. Now, the researchers emphasized on their vulnerability. Every small and seemingly unimportant thing could harm the child's psyche. Vulnerability was not just a condition. Rather, it was assumed to be an important and inherent feature, a feature that combined with parents' concerns about upbringing, creating a new culture. The prevailing atmosphere used to tell parents that you don't know anything about raising your child. Of course, this was true. Parents of the late 20th century did not have a correct understanding of the concept of raising a child, because the traditional process of gaining experience had changed. Their desperation and concern seemed completely right, but the question was, what should be the answer to this concern?
So you're saying it doesn't matter how I treat my children. Now, it may be a natural reaction at first, but think about it. Of course it matters how you treat your children. It's never okay to abuse or belittle or neglect children, because that's a terrible thing for a big, strong person to do to a small, helpless one who is under that person's care. Child rearing, above all, is a moral responsibility. Also, let's say someone told you that you can't shape the personality of your spouse. Now, no one but a newlywed really believes that you can change the personality of your spouse. Nonetheless, on hearing this bit of wisdom, no one says, oh, so you're saying it doesn't matter how I treat my spouse. Well, of course it matters how you treat your spouse. It matters to the quality of the relationship that you have and the degree of pleasure and respect and depth that your relationship will enjoy. Likewise, parenting is a human relationship between two people, one of whom is a parent, one of whom is a child, and how the parent treated the child in childhood is going to affect the quality of that relationship. And I think it's a sign of the influence of the blank slate that so many people could forget this simple truth, or at least when intellectualizing they can forget it, and think of parenting only as the molding or micromanaging of a child's personality, whereas in fact it's much more than that.
It was the parenting industry that answered this question first. In the first place, this industry told parents that they should be trained to raise children. This is why there were so many classes from pregnancy to adolescence. The same is the case with many education-related products. Parents saw raising a child as an activity, something like going to university or working. The traditional concept of raising a child was not understandable for them, because raising a child was now considered a goal that parents had to reach by any means. An approach that caused the lives of new generations to deviate from the main path.
When we raise kids this way, and I'll say we, because Lord knows in raising my two teenagers, I've had these tendencies myself, our kids end up leading a kind of checklisted childhood. And here's what the checklisted childhood looks like. We keep them safe and sound and fed and watered. And then we want to be sure they go to the right schools, but not just that, that they're in the right classes at the right schools, and that they get the right grades in the right classes in the right schools. But not just the grades, the scores. And not just the grades and scores, but the accolades and the awards and the sports and the activities and the leadership. And all of this is done to some hoped-for degree of perfection. We expect our kids to perform at a level of perfection we were never asked to perform at ourselves. And so because so much is required, we think.
Baby Einstein Company was founded in the mid-90s, that is, in the peak years of the changing approach to parenting. This new approach could be seen everywhere, from academic environments to stores and even places like movie theaters. The Home Alone series was kind of about that, about how to deal with children. In these movies, Kevin faced the consequences of his parents' misbehavior, the behavior that could be seen in the blockbuster movie Mrs. Doubtfire. The children in that movie had Kevin's problems somehow. a serious challenge with parenting. This issue was reflected in a movie like Jumanji and many animations of that decade in different ways. Watching these works, parents ask themselves the same question. What is the correct way of parenting? The answer to this important question was a form of extreme parenting. Parents had decided to monitor their child's growth like a helicopter. That is why the term helicopter parent was born. This term had no meaning except paternalism upbringing. Controlling the children 24/7 and raising them under the strict supervision. These conditions started from the very first years. Young children had to stare at baby Einstein's video contents for hours. If they started walking, it was time to go to exercise class. If they started talking, it was time to learn a second or third language. When they were 5 or 6 years old, learning to draw in kindergarten took all their time. But these cases were only the introduction of the main stage. The main stage started with the first day of school. Learning sports, language, painting, and music continued. And now it was time to study. Extra classes after school should not be forgotten. The same went for using private tutors. Even long vacations and summers were not time for rest. Going to camps for several months, encouraging preparation for the next school year, and also dealing with sports and art were important principles. The principles that received more attention upon reaching the high school years. In the years when the teenager was preparing to enter the university, the educational conditions changed. Now it was time for the children of this type of parents to study day and night. Having fun in any form was sinful and contrary to the future. The auxiliary classes, private tutors, and numerous aptitude tests were supposed to get them to the best universities. Of course, the education process did not end with entering the university. The migration of the family to the city where the child studied was the first step. After that, mandatory material and spiritual aid, a process for which the researchers chose a name, a strange phenomenon called boomerang children. It seemed that kids with this upbringing ended up getting the best jobs, but statistics said something else. A study in the U.S. says that about 40% of men aged 18 to 34 in this country still live with their families. A strange incident that is the result of paternalism upbringing. Children who have lived with forced dependence for years return to their parents' house after education like a boomerang. This is a common and bitter phenomenon. Of course, the economic situation is an important reason for the situation of boomerang children, but it doesn't explain everything. The issue is a bit more complicated than economic reasons.
Trusted you 1,000 times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough. But sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Is there any way left to save me? I need someone. change my dreams, they're too deep. You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to Viewpoints with me, Atal, the host of this program. I'm here with two respected guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mahdi and Sister Zainab. Sister Zainab, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum salam, brother, and to all the listeners this morning.
And Brother Mahdi, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi to you too.
Okay, can the Western powers be trusted? What does historical record show us? Sister Zainab.
Okay, well, look, just to make it a bit easier, I'd actually specifically looked at the US because, you know, just gives us an example. And look, obviously, there's a big history of not sort of ratifying treaties anyway. But I went back in, because when you look into this, it takes you back as far as, for example, the first treaties that they were sort of making with the Native American tribes.
Oh.
And interestingly, so for just to, and this gives a really good sort of idea of what the U.S. government is about. I'm not saying U.S. people, but U.S. government and sort of the way they behave. So, for example, and this might be interesting for listeners, it was interesting for me, there were 374 treaties made with Native American tribes. Only one article of one treaty was ever respected. And then there were other things. So the U.S. was part of the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, never ratified it. There's a 1949 International Labor Convention signed by 154 countries. U.S. never ratified it. There's an International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, 1966, ratified by 166 countries, of course, not ratified by the U.S. So this just gives us a... what's the idea we get from this? And that is that the U.S. in particular is probably the most untrustworthy government in the world when it comes to treaties. So history tells us that, basically.
That's right. Okay. So the withdrawal from agreements... Is there their habit, Sayyid Mahdi? I mean,
yeah.
Withdrawing from agreements, international one. We had it in the JCPOA of Iran, you know. So bad, bad, notorious records in the Western world, especially the U.S.
Yeah, right. So I think one of the things that's interesting to talk about is something called American exceptionalism. And so that's this idea or this philosophy that whatever America does is good. Mm-hmm. And that they're exceptional, right? They're unique in the world.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, face value, you might think, okay, what's the big deal? Every country in one way or the other has some sort of nationalism. But this is kind of like, I don't know, extremist nationalism to the point where everything that the United States does is good. It's also very reminiscent of like the very fascist systems of the recent past, World War II, you know, Stalin and Hitler. They also had this very extreme, whatever we do is the best, everybody else is wrong. And, you know, you see this in the Zionist regime, this ultra-Zionist, ethnocentric type thing, to the point where even if you kill everybody else, it's okay, as long as we stay alive, you know? Mm-hmm. So when you have that kind of a mentality, then of course you're going to, you know, break every single deal out there, or you're going to not, you know, be trustworthy, because you're only going to do whatever you want to do. And this is what is manifested
in America. So why make it a deal? I mean, so many international organizations are in the U.S. The U.N. is over there, you know, headquarters. So many human rights movements, you know, offices here and there. So why making deals and then breaking that?
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Either maybe they make a deal hoping that the other party will stick to the deal. So, for example, JCPOA is an interesting example.
Bad job,
you know?
As they say,
all of them came together, made the deal, and then America left the deal.
Yes.
Called it a bad deal. You know, but then the Islamic Republic abided by the, you know, the accords of the JCPOA.
Yes.
So it's a very, I don't know, it's a very evil type, sneaky, bad thing to do. It's huge, right? So, and this is what's happened. So on one hand, they bound the Islamic Republic within the JCPOA. Then they broke the accords themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are blaming the Islamic Republic that the Islamic Republic is breaking the accord when they're the only one that's abiding by the terms of the JCPOA. So I don't know. It's a very messed up situation.
You know? And the IAEA resolutions.
Yeah.
Come on. We are abiding by that. And then we made a deal. So, and we were negotiating, so-called negotiation. And come on, look at the wisdom of a rapper, you know?
Yeah.
It has always said that, not only I do not trust U.S., but also three important European countries. I do not trust them. So he said it on and off, you know, here in his addresses. So historical exploitation and double standards of the West, Sister Zainab. So why is still so many countries, you know, in the world and in the eastern part of the world, especially the West Asia or something like that, you know, they trust U.S. and its allies?
Yeah, I was just thinking that. I've no idea. So there's this, and this has been going on for, I don't know, is it 100 years?
Yes.
They've constructed this idea of the U.S. being the, you know, this is the culture. This is the land of freedom, of opportunities, for however else they've sold it and all the products. The whole consumer culture thing, obviously, from there too.
American
and, you know,
dream.
Why? So, okay, so everyone, the whole world bought into it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say that the whole world went around the whole globe. But now why is everyone still buying into it?
Mm-hmm.
Even when we see images of the leaders of Western countries in the Oval Office with President Trump sitting there like four-year-olds being told off, having to sort of, pay, you know, be obedient to whatever their master, their headmaster, whatever.
That was a shame.
And it's humiliating.
At least more respectful than 8 years ago. Because they were all standing and Donald Trump sitting down. Now they were given the chair to sit down and listen to.
It's interesting. I mean, you could kind of like...
and compare it with a rapper's stance, you know?
Yeah.
How powerful is he?
Yeah. It's, you know, you can... You have two. You have one, you have the Muslim world and the leaders of the, of the Muslim world and Muslim countries are, you know, one, I guess, one party in this discussion. And the other one is the non-Muslim leaders, like these European leaders.
Yes.
You know, and both of them, for some reason, kind of have their hopes somehow pinned on America. And so when you come to the Muslim leaders in this part of the world, primarily it just comes down to that these leaders do not have faith in the Almighty God. They do not have faith in Islam. They do not have faith in their own people, you know. And so because they're afraid from their own people, and they're afraid of losing their thrones and their kingships and their kingdoms and these things. And then, you know, they gravitate towards America to help them retain their power. European countries, I really don't understand, because there's not that dimension of having God, right? So if they disobey, okay. America is not like they're obeying God.
But right.
Somehow I think, you know, after World War One and World War Two, they have also politically and economically gravitated towards America because of different historical things. America came out relatively strong in both of these wars, and they, you know, they kind of indebted Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And Europe, I think, before Donald Trump, Europe and U.S. were kind of like one team on the same page. Donald Trump came in and he kind of, you know, pushed Europe towards the background, and again, American exceptionalism. That America is the greatest power.
Okay.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
But the Eastern world, you know, is doing its own works. You know, the cooperation, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, is one of them. BRICS is another one of them. The late Shahid Raisi was one of the, the presidents who was after, you know, BRICS allowed the membership over there. And these developments challenged the unipolar moment that followed the Cold War and potentially alternative partnerships for the Muslim majorities countries. But we... as Islamic Republic of Iran, our leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has always said that we do not trust U.S. and its allies. And some people criticize him of cutting the ties with the world and international bodies. And, this puts lots of pressures on Iran through sanctions. So why not going and negotiating or talking or something like that?
You know, one of the reasons I assume is because obviously you've just mentioned the there's the two different concepts. We've got this sort of unipolar hegemonic view of the world, which is U.S. centered, mm-hmm. especially some of the other Western countries, European countries, part of that, and also sort of Australia, New Zealand. And then there's the much better idea that people talk about and they've been talking about for quite some time, the multipolar world, where, no, we don't have one hegemonic system. And obviously Iran in particular is sort of good at wanting to have good neighborly relations and looking towards the East, what we call the East. So, you know, obviously this is sort of really one region, whether we're sort of in West Asia or in East Asia, this is sort of one big landmass, so really there should be these mm-hmm. connections. And it's whether... So I tend to see that obviously the U.S. has to fight very hard now because they understand that this hegemonic system is coming to an end and that there will be a high degree of multipolarity with different systems in the world operating.
Mm-hmm.
And now the only way they can do this is to sort of try to get more support, rally even stronger support for their hegemonic system. And of course, the way their hegemonic system operates, and it really is just theirs, no other system in the world operates according to this US hegemonic system, that is, you must create enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the other power, Russia, so obviously they've had to set Russia up as an enemy.
Yes.
And now obviously, the Islamic countries, especially obviously the Shia countries are the other this region, and West Asia, the very sort of independent-minded countries,
mm-hmm.
they are the big enemy.
Yes, so-called big enemy for them. In order to make a scenario and attack the lands, you know, maybe at the end of the day, they are after their resources, Said Mehdi, isn't it?
Yeah, right, and this is what the colonial systems, you know, throughout hundreds of years, centuries, is based upon. It's based upon going and usurping and looting and plundering the natural and human resources of the various places that they go and they invade and they mm-hmm. colonize. Imam Khomeini, you know, rahmatullah alayh, Allah's peace and blessings be upon him. You know, he called the Zionist entity a cancer. And I think the whole system of domination, the system of the arrogant powers, the hegemonic systems, this, I guess, American exceptionalism and Western exceptionalism and Zionism, all of these are really cancers, you know. Just like cancer, they go and they feed off of live, you know, healthy cells, and they infect them and then make them sick, and then they move on to the next, you know, healthy cell. And so it's, it just seems like this is what they're doing across the world.
And they're going down, you know, they're drowning with the Zionism.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they trust the Zionism with their project, and now everybody's criticizing the U.S. and the European countries. Why trusting on the Zionism, especially on the Gaza? You know, killing so many people over there. Genocide is happening over there. And still going on. I mean, what is exactly going on behind the scene? Why, you know, so much trust on the Zionism? Is the money of Zionism at work or something? I don't know. Are they paid or something? I don't know. Maybe they're
so,
paid.
Yeah, like, you know, there's so many different variables, and I'll let the sister also add. It's kind of a can of worms, right, or a Pandora's box. If you open it, there's a lot of stuff going on. Yeah, one of them is money, in the sense where if you go to the various different countries in the West, the United States, United Kingdom, you have these very huge, powerful Zionist lobbies who, you know, they pay for these congressmen or senators or representatives to be in the government. And, of course, when you pay somebody, one way or the other, you get your money's worth. And that's through laws or the support of the Zionist regime or things like that. That's just, you know, one aspect of what's going on and the control of these lobbies in the various Western countries.
Okay, that's it. Sister Zainab, your final remarks?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of this is driven by the U.S., of course. And then, of course, interestingly, this continues, this idea of, okay, well, so we're going to take these countries, we're going to plunder their resources, been going on for hundreds of years. And, of course, what we see happening in Gaza is like the current manifestation in its most horrific, violent form, especially as all the countries are, you know, spectating, basically. And this, and of course, Trump, who sits in a country, I don't know, 10,000 kilometers away from Gaza, comes up with a plan to sort of take it over and develop into a sort of develop tourist infrastructure. So we have to ask ourselves, what does this country have to do with Gaza? And how can other countries that have rational human beings, presumably were human beings, were rational, how can they actually agree to this or just sit back and listen to this and think this is okay? So this is something maybe people need to be a bit more aware of. What's going on? So this, what's happening in Gaza is also like a manifestation of this colonialism. Because obviously the idea is if the Trump thing were to go ahead, they just develop it, and of course they take the resources off the coast of Gaza too. It's the money. It's the stuff they can get out.
All right.
People are irrelevant. They're a nuisance. And I can put in strong, say strong words. They just, they don't even just treat, they refer to people as animals, but even animals they treat better in the West. So no, they're not treating the people like animals. They're treating them like, I don't know, ants or cockroaches. And the ant, which maybe refers back to the Quran, because even the ant is such an amazing creature, according to Allah.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sister Zainab, Said Mehdi, for a nice elaboration on this topic. Are the West and the so-called global powers trustworthy, and what does history tell us? Do they have good records or not? For sure not. Thank you very much. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This was Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website, iranradio.irt. And another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me, and I try to remember not to take anything for granted, 'cause I know
this will all come to an end. So my last wish is for you to be pleased with me.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a very interesting question. And that question is related to a theme which recurringly is mentioned in the Holy Quran and the Hadith. Of course, I'm speaking about the remembrance of God, or what we call in Arabic, dhikrullah. In many places in our religious scriptures, this has been, you know, mentioned. By way of example, in one beautiful verse of the Holy Quran, we read, O you who have faith, do not let your possessions and your children distract you from the remembrance of God. And whoever does that, it is they who are the losers. So in this beautiful verse, Allah advises us to remember Him, and He equates the neglectfulness of God, which is the opposite of His remembrance, as being tantamount to loss, or what we call in Arabic, khusran. Consequently, the remembrance of God leads to man's felicity and his success in this world and in the hereafter. Now, the question we want to pose today with respect to this theme and this topic is, what are the benefits of the remembrance of God? Or to put it in other terms, what are the consequences and results of remembering God? In order to answer this question, we can take inspiration from the hadith and the verses of the Holy Quran in which this topic has been alluded to. By way of example, in one beautiful hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam has been reported as having said this: the one whose heart thrives with a continuous remembrance of God, his actions will always be good, whether done in secret or openly. So one of the consequences of remembering God is that, of course, if this remembrance is continuous and uninterrupted, is that the actions of the person will be good. In a beautiful hadith, which has been narrated also from Imam Ali, it has been said that the root of reforming the heart lies in occupying it with the remembrance of God. This is hadith, and that it says that the islahul qalb, or the reforming of the heart, somebody has certain problems, certain psychological maladies, and he wants to reform them and become better, then the principal basis and foundation of this reformation lies in remembering God. It cannot be done without remembering God, no matter how much medicine one consumes, no matter how much counseling sessions one takes, you know, takes part in, it will be of no avail unless it is coupled with the remembrance of God Almighty. In one nice hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "The remembrance of God is a provision for the souls and a close sitting in the company of the beloved." So meaning when we remember God, we come into his presence, and when we come into his presence, you know, obviously the effects of that are understood and well known. Thank you for joining us here in The Key. We were looking at the results and fruits of the remembrance of God in light of the hadith. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Say that love strikes only once, that precious moment I offer you. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rope? You are my God. Presence gives me strength, gives vision to my sight. Someday faith will increase, someday our wars will cease, someday there'll be justice, someday there will be possess, I offer you. I want to be someone whom you can trust. Come save us from a world that's so unjust. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where
from beautiful Tehran, a heartfelt salam to each of you. You're tuned in Iran Radio, and I'm your host here to guide you through an enriching day of discovery and insight. Please settle in. What you'll hear today just might make your day brighter. We begin this hour with further radio productions. Then join us for Bridge, a brief commentary on profound supplications, hosted by Sheikh Mehdi Dardashtian. Bridge offers a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications of the Noble Book of Sahifa Sajjadiyya by Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him. Next, we open the door to Dialogue, hosted by Sayyid Shahriyar Naqvi. Dialogue is a look at the most important conversations and dialogues between Shia infallible imams with their followers, questioners, and leaders of different Islamic faith and sects on various religious topics and doctrines, and also political, social, and cultural issues. Following this, we'll feature more of our radio productions. Stay tuned. The next is another segment of our radio productions.
Kerman is counted as one of the oldest cities, and it was founded as a defensive outpost with the name Veh Ardashir by Ardashir I, founder of the Sasanid Empire, in the 3rd century AD. Kerman was ruled by Turkmens, Arabs, and Mongols after the 7th century, and was expanded rapidly during the Safavid dynasty. When Marco Polo visited Kerman in 1271, it had become a major trade center linking the Persian Gulf with Khorasan and Central Asia.
Ganjadi Khan was the governor of Kerman during the Safavid era. He ruled thousands of cities and towns from Fars province all the way to the city of Herat in today's Afghanistan. During his time, he built lots of public places in the city of Kerman, including this huge square, bazaar, mosque, and a public bath.
Kerman's Jame, or Central Mosque, is a part of the Muzaffari Aggregate and was completed in 1345 AD. By Amir Mubarizuddin Muhammad Muzaffari Meybudi Yazdi. The mosque is one of the most ancient structures of the country and a remnant of the Iranian monarchs after the Alibuye dynasty. The mosque has a tall gateway in its eastern sector, and the same has been decorated with beautiful tile work. A clock tower aids in the enhancement of this entrance. The structure has been constructed in a symmetrical fashion and has a winter and summer porch.
Walking through dark and narrow halls to enter a huge and lighted area is a style in Islamic architecture of the Safavid era to give you the sense of joy and pleasure of entering a place like a public bath, which was not only for personal sanitation, but also for socializing, with people coming, sitting down, smoking hookah and pipe, and talking about social and political issues, or even finding husbands and wives for their kids, back in the old days style.
Built in the Safavid period, this courtyard is home to what was once Kerman's most important hammam, or bathhouse, the Hammam Ganjali Khan, now restored and transformed into a museum. With the conversion of the population of Iran to Islam, ritual purity through washing one's body became a requirement of religious life. Thenceforth, bathing became an integral part of life. Besides, baths were frequented not only for purity and hygienic reasons, but also for medical purposes. Physicians prescribed taking the waters against a great variety of ailments.
Whenever I get a chance to travel to different cities of this beautiful land of Iran, I definitely stop by the bazaar of that city. Not just for shopping, but for the whole experience. Experience of meeting people from different backgrounds, with different ethnicities, different ages, different dialects, and so on. Another part of this experience is the pleasant scent of the bazaar. Smells of colorful and different spices, dried fruits, and even dried dairy products. It's just amazing.
A review of Iran's economic and social history indicates that the bazaar has always been a pillar of civic foundations. No town could survive without the bazaar, whether big or small. Some have allegorically described bazaar as the economic heartbeat of the Iranian cities. The ancient Iranian bazaars have gradually evolved into an encompassing section of the town. A bazaar was not a secluded section of the town, but home to a wide spectrum of goods and services sought by the townspeople. Archaeologists could find proofs of the existence of a 6,000-year-old bazaar in a place called Khabis near Kerman, a place which is now called Shahdad. I know you definitely want to know more about Kerman, and I'm not finished exploring this city. So we'll see you soon in the next program about some other attractions of Kerman. Shahryar Azimi for Iran.
Heard the boastful Persian saying that art only belongs to Iranians. With their wide variety in color and patterns, and each motif and design specific to a particular region, Persian carpets are definitely something to boast about.
In Iran, carpets have always been both symbolic and practical. A popular design that is often used in this region is called Rizmahi, which means the little fish.
Quality craftsmanship is the name of the game, and the painstaking procedure of knotting, invented by ancient Persians, is a means to reflect a people's identity. It may take a group of up to 15 carpet weavers nearly a year to create the masterpieces that will be decorating the floors, giving any room warmth and style. Iranians are definitely the masters of weaving. Jajim, which is a kind of thick two-sided cloth, itself can be considered enough evidence to support the boastful statement that art only belongs to Iranians.
There was a time when jajim was considered a luxury item, but today it's used for making traditional handbags, something you can take back home as a souvenir from Iran.
Jajim is normally 2.5 meters long and 2 meters wide. And although its patterns may vary, the simpler and more common jajim includes stripes 1 to 5 centimeters wide of different colors. Sometimes to create a checkered pattern, colorful wraps are used. Traditionally, though, jajim is woven on a horizontal loom with colorful fine threads of wool and usually by a single weaver. Both sides of the jajim can be used, which is why it has become a multi-purpose article, often quilted and used as a cover or blanket, and sometimes even spread on the ground. The taste and talent of these people can also be seen through the designs of their earthenware. Pottery is perhaps the earliest and most important invention of mankind in Iran, dating back to the 7th millennium BC. In the small town of Khusf, not much has changed since the invention of the potter's wheel. Symmetry is omnipresent in Persian craftsmanship. The detailed patterns of the 7,000-year-old art of marquetry are no exception. When it comes to decorating your home traditionally, wooden lattice doors and windows with stained glass are things you simply can't miss. The number of wooden pieces needed for each door is striking. It is usually beechwood or sycamore that is considered the best for refined carving at this level.
Woodwork like this dates back at least 1,500 years. Some historians say it even dates back to the Sassanid era. So, I guess we have to admit that there's at least a little bit something to the Persian